markets look really optimistic this morning. Dow futures up 440 points. NASDAQ futures up 143 points. So it sounds like it's either this latest announcement from the Federal Reserve or that big deal over the weekend at the G20. Let's go to CBS Foreign Affairs analyst Pamela Falk. It's been billed as a ceasefire in the trade war with China, Pamela, but this is all based on what the president sort of ad-libbed on Air Force One. What do we know? What's actually locked down here?
What they're saying is locked down, good morning, Dave, is that the U.S., President Trump, agreed not to boost tariffs on the $200 billion of Chinese goods from 10 to 25% on January 1. And the Chinese have agreed to not boost their tariffs and lower tariffs on some industries. Now, all of that is not signed and agreed to. It was done at the G20, but it certainly seems to be a ceasefire on the trade wars. And as you know, Dave, this was the first face-to-face meeting between Xi Jinping and President Trump since this whole trade war, if you want to call it that, It began with President Trump complaining that China has done nothing to cut its a very large surplus with the United States, in other words, in bilateral trade.
So it sounds like it went well, although I heard some discouraging words, predictably, from Democrats who said that there were no protections for workers and that we didn't handle the theft of intellectual property by the Chinese.
Yes. In fact, China signaled that it would allow a tie-up between two major semiconductors manufacturers, which Chinese regulators have been blocking. But generally speaking, we haven't heard anyway any specifics about protection of intellectual property, and it certainly had no mention, at least, of the U.S. Labor issues that have been very high on the agenda for Democrats in trying to make sure that this stops and the economy goes better. Now, the one good piece is that we have already seen the markets respond, and that's on the same news that we have, which may not be complete, or the deal may not be complete, but the markets have jumped up.
So inevitably, the question will be asked across dinner tables, which side blinked, can we say?
I think both sides in this sense. Certainly China decided this was not helping their economy. And I would say it was pretty much mutual in terms of the agreement. I would say to some extent China probably blinked a little more because President Trump was threatening this increase from 10 to 25% and decided not to do that. But it also comes at a very tough time, as you know, for the president. And today's news is that there was an off-camera mic that caught President Trump saying, "Get me out of here," as he left President Macri on stage, the Argentine president, on his way out, just having had enough. Yeah. Since so much was going on at home, the questions of whether or not to meet with Vladimir Putin after the Ukraine, the Khashoggi murder, everything was going on at the same time. But in terms of China, it does look like the increase of tariffs may have pushed the deal to happen.
Well, good.
Then
he was right about that. And it sounds like, as I mentioned, investors are really happy. So on the Trump-Putin close encounter, what did they do? I didn't see any of the video. Did they shake hands? Did they meet? What did they do?
Yeah, they met. It was not an official meeting, but they did meet. They did talk.
I assume they didn't discuss the Trump Tower in Moscow, right?
They didn't. As far as we know, they didn't. And he hasn't given a full readout of it. Just to say, they had a short encounter. It was not what either President Putin of Russia or President Trump wanted, because they wanted to reset relations. I mean, that was one of the first things Trump said when he came into office. And it didn't also seem that there was any talk or tough talk like Macron did with the Saudi crown prince. It wasn't any tough talk on Ukraine. Yeah. And that's a very tense situation. And Ukraine sees it as something that's going to get worse because you still, to this day, have not heard President Trump say anything very tough about Ukraine. I mean, you've, in fact, his national security advisor, John Bolton, just said, oh, listen to what Nikki Haley said, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., who was very tough on Russia, saying this is a violation of international law. It's outrageous.
Well, now, what are we talking about, Pamela? Do you think that Putin is going to start a war here? Or
Ukrainians do. I mean, they do. They have military buildup at their border. They believe that the fact that taking three ships and moving the sailors that they arrested to Moscow and everything that they have done, not seeing a U.S. reaction, they certainly have seen an international reaction, but not seeing a U.S. reaction to it that was terribly negative, other than the ambassador to the U.N. who is leaving at the end of the month, that the Ukrainians are worried that this means more aggression against Crimea. And mainly, they've also been saying that the Russians have been blocking their trade routes anyway because they want to cut off trade between Ukraine and Crimea.
Right, but we helped arm Ukraine, right? Didn't President Trump send arms over there? So I mean, they can defend themselves supposedly.
Right, not exactly, but they are moving their troops and they're asking for NATO help. That's the main thing, and NATO hasn't made any decision about what to do about this.
One more thing: the bro shake between Putin and Mohammed bin Salman, the prince who we are told anyway ordered the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Was that deliberate? Was that for the cameras? Was that a signal that, okay, we got away with it, or what?
I mean, we certainly can't read their minds, but looking at their faces, Dave, it was sort of an almost high five. They were laughing. They were smiling. It was right in front of the cameras, looking at the cameras, at least for Putin. And it was clearly a message. Now, the message from Putin has always been, and President Trump made it clear, that if the United States stops selling arms to Saudi Arabia, all of these arms deals will go to Russia. That seemed to be the point there. Now, this comes at a time when the Wall Street Journal has actually reported that 11 intercepts came between the Crown Prince and the hit squad killing Khashoggi during this whole process. So that seems to be why the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, has come to the conclusion, and she's the head of it, has been blocked from testifying to Congress by the White House. She came to the conclusion the Crown Prince was involved. So there's going to be, as we know, and after January, when the new Democratic Congress is in, a call to do something more than just a somewhat tame sanctions against 17 Saudi officials.
Right. Pamela Falk, live from the UN. Pamela, thank you very much.
Absolutely, Dave. Always a pleasure.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Is vaping a gateway to smoking for teenagers, or could it actually help them avoid cigarettes? Let's call in the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, this involves a study done at Georgetown University. What did they find?
Yeah, this study was just completed, and it was interesting because they found that as kids started increasing their use of vaping or e-cigarettes, they started to smoke less. So they're consuming significantly less cigarettes now that vaping is available.
Now, is vaping itself less dangerous than inhaling something that's actually burning?
This is quite a...
Because you're still getting nicotine, right?
Right. A vaping device is officially known as an electronic nicotine delivery system. And the way it works is it heats a liquid. It's sometimes called e-juice or something like that. And it's heated until a vapor, it's not smoke, until a vapor is created. And then the user inhales that vapor. And so there's no smoke going into the lungs. There's no products of combustion going into the lungs. And so a lot of the harms that are associated with smoking are related to the burning into the products of combustion rather than to the nicotine itself. The problem is with nicotine is that it's a highly addictive substance. But the truth is that nobody really is aware of any long-term negative health effects from it. And it's a controversial area, but right. There aren't really good studies that have demonstrated any long-term harm to consuming nicotine.
I know the head of the FDA has taken a strong stand on this, saying that he doesn't want kids addicted to vaping. But what you're saying is, while nicotine is addictive, the main consequence is you're addicted, but it's not causing any harm? I thought that it increased, it led to heart disease. Or is that the particulates instead of the nicotine?
Yeah, that's the particulates. Those are the other chemicals. There's over 150 different poisons, basically, that are in cigarettes that are responsible for all the negative health effects of it. Whereas with vaping, you're inhaling this vapor. So this study is quite interesting because they went out to see, well, what happened during the period of time that e-cigarettes have been out. And when the e-cigarette use came in to the marketplace, smoking rates dropped between 25 and 40%. But smoking rates in young adults have dropped by over 50%. And most of that has been since 2013. And so the government wants to regulate and create very tough restrictions surrounding e-cigarettes. But, you know, the scientists who conducted this study at Georgetown are concerned that it would potentially reverse the trends of the dropping smoking rates. And we really know how bad smoking is for all of us.
So this is not a moral crusade worth engaging in, is what you're saying.
It's not a moral crusade worth engaging in. I do think that we need to understand and do a better job of understanding what the risks of nicotine in isolation along with propylene glycol are when inhaled over a long period of time. I mean, there's been concern that vaping is a gateway to smoking, but that actually hasn't really bared out. In fact, people tend to stick with the vaping.
But what you're saying is the latest research indicates that if you were to somehow curtail vaping, all it would do would be to force people into a more dangerous alternative, that being smoking a burning material.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem. And, you know, look, I don't want to come across as leading people to believe that vaping is a harmless activity because it isn't. You are consuming a chemical. You are consuming a stimulant. You can become addicted to a substance. But many experts out there are suggesting that vaping is the lesser of two evils.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
It is a fact that most of the people currently incarcerated are going to be released someday, and they have to live somewhere. That includes patients with violent histories being released from Western State Hospital and other facilities into adult group homes or into the community in some other way. It has been an ongoing legal and political battle in the city of Lakewood, and the mayor says it has now reached a tipping point. And Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott is covering that story.
And Dave, Lakewood Mayor Don Anderson says part of the issue in his city is the disproportionate number of adult family home businesses, with 20 new ones so far this year, bringing the total number of these homes to 93 in Lakewood, roughly 28% of the total number of adult family homes in all of Pierce County. That's too many under state law. But the biggest issue for Mayor Anderson?
DSHS has embarked on a policy of placing violent offenders and dangerous sex offenders in these homes without notice to the other people in the homes, without notice to the neighborhood, and without regard for the safety of the people who are going to be in close proximity to people who have violent and criminal tendencies.
So adult family homes are places where people go to age, they're not set up specifically for people who are being released as patients from these type of facilities or criminals and things of that nature. They're where your older people go to live, things like that. As far as the patients that we're talking about from Western State Hospital or even the Special Commitment Center on McNeil Island who are being released to these facilities, it's not that they have not been dangerous in the past and don't have criminal histories.
Because some of these folks are forensic flips. They go into Western State Hospital on the forensic side where they're evaluated for their competency to stand trial. They aren't deemed to be competent to stand trial or they're found not guilty on an insanity plea. The forensic side releases them to the civil side. The civil side lets them out.
Anderson says they sued DSHS and the state earlier this year to end the practice of placing violent offenders into these adult homes in Lakewood, but they lost. The judge ruled that state law preempts local jurisdictions from regulating adult family home businesses and made clear that any change to that would have to come from the governor and the state legislature. Anderson says they warned at the time that it was just going to be a matter of time before something horrible happened. Last month it did, when a patient with a violent past who had been committed to Western State three times was released to one of these adult homes, attacked a resident there who later died from their injuries. Mayor Anderson says that was the tipping point for him, and enough is enough. Republican State Senator Steve O'Bann, who represents Lakewood, agrees.
We need an absolute ban on placing violent offenders in adult family homes. Adult family homes, particularly in Lakewood, my district, are located in residential areas near schools. This is the absolute wrong place for individuals who have violent pasts, including child abusers. Even an individual who murdered an 11-year-old child is about to be placed into an adult family home in Lakewood in my district.
Now, he's referencing there the one of the three sex offenders from the Special Commitment Center on McNeil Island that were set to be released by the end of last month to a home in those in that community. Mayor Anderson's message to the governor?
Call the head of DSHS and tell them not to put violent offenders in adult family homes. That can be all it takes is a phone call. Put a moratorium on that and go to the legislature with a proposal to provide adequate facilities for the care of these people.
It is the same message that Senator O'Bann has been pushing. Now, I reached out to the governor's office, and here's what I was told. Quote, we understand the community's concerns and agree we need more placement options around the state and have invited legislators to work with us on that effort. Now, follow-ups from me asking where he stood on taking that executive action for a moratorium to stop the practice went unanswered. DSHS told me that they do not have the authority to impose a moratorium, but even if they did, such a restriction would likely violate the federal and state civil rights of these patients and run counter to the DSHS mission, which is to, quote, transform lives by supporting sustainable recovery, independence, and wellness. Not very much solace for Lakewood's mayor.
They don't seem to care that lives are at stake. The pressure is to get people out of Western State and off McNeil Island. And the more throughput there is, the better it is for the machine. But it's not good for the community.
So this person who was released and then killed the other resident of the group home, had that person been certified cured?
Had landed under the civil commitment umbrella, which then leads to you being released back into the community when you're coming out of Western State.
This is the question, right? What is the standard for being released into the community? Is it just because you served a certain length of time or because you've been examined and the problem that caused you to become violent has been fixed somehow?
You have, in all of these cases, been analyzed by someone at the hospital who has deemed that it's okay for you to be released under that civil commitment umbrella into what the ideal thing is, to be released to an enhanced services facility. That's similar to a place I toured up in Everett with the governor earlier this year. They have extra staffing and supervision and things for these type of folks. That is not what an adult family home is, and that's where these people are going. They don't have that kind of supervision.
Why are they allowed to go there?
They're getting in this, there's this loophole. It's very convoluted and that's been going on for a long time. There's going to be efforts in the legislature to clarify the state law that this cannot happen. But there's not enough of these other facilities I'm talking about. There's only a handful in the state. And even the one I just went and toured with the governor a couple of months ago didn't have the ability to let any patients into the 16-bed facility because they don't have the nurses. There's a nursing shortage. So it's a really complicated issue.
I thought we used to have a facility like that at McNeil Island itself.
Not that particular one. And again, there's trying to push. We've got a little over 200 offenders who are still on McNeil Island. The majority of that is obviously closed. We're talking about Special Commitment Center on that island. They go through what an evaluation to be placed in something called a less restrictive alternative. So they have to be determined whether from the evaluators there at the island, whether they are still sexually violent predators, whether it makes sense for them to be released into the community. What these folks are saying is that they're not getting any transparency from this. The mayor of Lakewood, Senator O'Bann, others in the community of Lakewood feel like, because they are so close to Western State, they're getting way more than their fair share of these people. Yeah. And that's the other thing. There's also going to be legislation to, you're supposed to go have it under state law be a priority to focus on where these folks were committed, what home community they come from, and place them back there if possible, not in this close vicinity to a Western state like they are right now. So there's a lot going on here, something I'll keep tabs on. At this point, not working for them. But I want to point out also some folks argue on the other side that it's kind of a NIMBY thing, right? There's residential areas here that people don't want.
Most people say no way.
Yeah, no way.
You can't persuade me that they won't offend again.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So.
Kyra is Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet. The adjacent states of America. Your daily dose of kindness now. It's brought to you by Spring Free Trampoline. It's about UK's Royal Mail Service going above and beyond for a 7-year-old boy who needed to get a letter to his dad. Complicating delivery service, though. The little boy addressed the letter to heaven. That's where it needed to go. His mom posted about it on Facebook a few weeks ago. She explained Jace, her son, wrote a letter to his dad in heaven and instructed the UK Royal Mail to get it there. He wrote, "Mr. Postman, can you please take this to heaven for my dad's birthday? Thanks." The Royal Mail Service wrote back, "Dear Jace, while we've been delivering your post, we've become aware of some concerns, so I just wanted to take this opportunity to contact you about how we succeeded in the delivery of the letter to your dad in heaven. This was a difficult challenge, avoiding stars and other galactic objects en route to heaven. The Royal Mail assured Jace that the card was delivered and told him it is their priority to get customers' mail where it needs to go. And his mom wrote on Facebook, "I cannot state how emotional he is knowing his dad got his card. You didn't have to make the effort. Thank you, and Merry Christmas."
7:47, time for the Sports Insider from your Western Washington Toyota dealer. And now here he is from that comforting crock pot of sports, 710 ESPN, Danny O'Neill. You predicted 35-13. You were wrong, but nobody cares because it was a great game.
I was pretty close to right, Dave. If we're going to sit there and we're going to count up my predictions, that was pretty close to right. I said 35-13, and what it turned out to be 43-16.
Yeah. So you predicted domination, but you sort of lowballed the domination.
Let me tell you, I'm going to be way more wrong in the future. That's pretty close to right compared to how my results are going to be if you're going to track it.
Yeah. All right. So what was the secret? I mean, was our debate. Is it because the Seahawks are great or because the 49ers are so bad?
Little bit of both. Russell Wilson was awesome. And the fact, I've never seen a quarterback early in the game, 2 minutes into the second quarter, he had thrown three passes. He had completed all three for 2 touchdowns and 101 yards in passing. That's unbelievable. At a point in the third quarter, he had as many touchdown passes as incompletions. But San Francisco was pretty gosh darn terrible.
Their defense just couldn't.
Yeah, their defense really couldn't do much. They were okay against the run. They committed 3 turnovers. There was at no point... That was as lopsided a result as you're going to get in football. And people will look back and say, oh, man, Nick Mullins, their quarterback threw for almost 400 yards. They were so far down. They trailed by 20 points before they scored. That was an old-fashioned whooping. In fact, when someone called me in the middle of the game and they're like, hey, have you seen the San Francisco 49ers? I was like, yeah, the Seattle Seahawks have them out back in the woodshed and they're just wailing on them.
Yeah.
So
and Bobby Richard, Wagner. Wow.
Bobby Wagner, that was pretty fun. He was out of breath, too. Did you see he had to lay down and take a nap? And then it all gets done, and Richard Sherman's asked about Russell Wilson's game.
Yeah.
Which is pretty standard stuff,
there's
right?
There's zero grace in that guy, is there?
No, there's not so much, which I would have lost respect for him if he would have caved. He's like, Russell was awesome. Funny. Let me tell you, I would have. At the end, and he was, of all the different numbers you could pick from Russell's game, the single least impressive was his passing yardage total. That was what Richard did. It was actually a pretty good backhanded compliment. He's like, he played pretty well. What do you have, 160, 170 yards? It's actually 185, but still not all that impressive. And he was like, they got him to his spots. They kept the game plan simple. It was as non-complimentary as you could be, given the game that Russell played.
Well, just looking at the cutaway shots of him on the sidelines, he looked very sad.
Sad! All by himself! Look who's sitting over there by himself wondering where did it all go wrong.
How was he received? Where the 49ers play, because nothing really came of the whole Richard Sherman, will anybody boo him thing. But I'm curious, do you think he was sad because he could feel the energy of CenturyLink? Maybe he missed it a little bit?
Yes. And I think that there's a little bit of, it wasn't his choice to leave. Yeah, the Seahawks cut him. Yes, I do think that there is. And the 49er fans like him. I hate 49er fans. It's one of my grudges.
Yeah. Who don't you hate?
Well, There's I don't dislike Husky fans. I like the Cougs, even though they got to the Alamo Bowl and they're upset about that. I like the Cougs. But they were like, oh, we've got Richard Sherman now when they signed him this offseason. I was like, yeah, you guys got him when he's not so good anymore. Enjoy that. See how that works out for you. And Richard played fine.
Yeah.
There was one pass that was completed in his direction and Doug Baldwin spun out of the tackle for a 21-yard game, but he wasn't the reason that they lost, and he certainly wasn't even close to being. He's not good enough. There's no single defender that would have been good enough to change the balance of that game.
Hey, did we know Bobby Wagner could run that fast?
Yeah.
We knew that.
Yeah, he's been one of the fastest middle linebackers.
Is he as fast as Tyler Lockett?
No. Lockett would probably get him. Bobby Wagner.
I was surprised, though, because Lockett got caught on that run. And,
don't tell him that, Dave.
Well, on the big screen. Okay,
he would have been caught by a second guy too if that guy hadn't got him. Yeah. He was getting walked down, as they put it. There is no one who weighs more than Bobby Wagner that runs faster than him.
Okay,
is that a good way to put it?
Yeah,
he's as fast for his anybody. Who's
I was just surprised.
Biggest,
I was just
him,
really surprised that he outran everything
like
that.
I guess I would say this: he is faster than anyone who's as big as him. And he's bigger than anyone who's faster than him.
And he actually set some Seahawks history with that interception return, too. I didn't realize that.
Longest play in franchise history.
I love it.
Wow. Yeah.
Pretty amazing stuff. All right. Well, here's hoping it continues. So they're at now what's the wild card story? They're at the top of the wild card list now?
They control their own destiny, Dave.
Oh, that's right. They control their own destiny. So in other words, if they win, if they just keep winning, nobody can keep them out of the playoffs.
Yes, because they control their own destiny.
Minnesota's next. How are we looking for that?
Monday night. Minnesota just lost to the Patriots. They come out here.
Wait, Monday night, not tonight?
No. Week from today.
I was going to say, that's crazy.
That would be a nuts
turnaround. I only got the momentum. They might as well play tonight.
Don't give the NFL any ideas, though. They'll do that.
Yeah. All right. Monday night. We'll talk about that later. Thank you, Danny.
All right. Talk to you soon.
George Herbert Walker Bush was the last American president to start and win a war and have the entire world on his side. Everybody except Saddam Hussein, of course. CBS military analyst and retired Army Major Mike Lyons joins us live now. Mike, you fought in Desert Storm, and I remember that HW was criticized at the time for not going far enough, for not going all the way to Baghdad. But history proved that that was the correct decision, didn't it?
No question, Dave. I was on the ground there, and I can tell you by the fourth day of ground combat, the Iraqi military was running out of Kuwait. They had their hands up. I came across many Iraqi soldiers who actually had their fingertips were shot off as they were trying to surrender, and in the fog of war, U.S. forces were still engaging them. So there's no question that we did the right thing by stopping from a humanitarian perspective. We would have occupied Iraq. We would have had to have owned it. We'd still be there now in ways that we can't imagine what it's like. So he did the U.N. Mission of ejecting the Iraqi military from Kuwait and completely did the right thing.
The other thing I remember about George H.W. Bush was that before that war, he was considered to be a wimpish leader. You remember that? Mm-hmm. Remember those years?
Yeah.
What did you think about that?
Well, yeah, there's a Newsweek cover story about him, and I actually, the reporter who wrote that story, fast forward 25 years, regrets that piece going. He was considered to be the wimp is what the wimp factor it was called back then from a political perspective, and it's because he was a nice guy. He, from my perspective, you go back now, you look in history, he clearly was someone who had to reach across the aisle. He had to deal with a Democratic Congress in both cases. When he was the president, he was tough as nails, I thought, and very steeled with regard to his leadership, especially during that conflict. And he also had the right people around him, Colin Powell in particular.
Right. And that's the other important thing, is to know who to surround yourself with. And he had considerable experience because he'd served in Congress, but also had served as head of the CIA. And talk a little bit about that. Talk about the importance of finding the right people to surround yourself with. I mean, who you were looking for in a role like that?
Yeah, the depth and breadth that he had. And he's a type of person that recognizes his shortcomings and found the people that filled those in. I thought both in Colin Powell's perspective from a strategic vision of someone who took advice. You look at James Baker as chief of staff, as Secretary of State, and his capability. Norman Schwarzkopf, the right guy on the ground tactically. He inspired the kind of combat that was required at the time there. You know, it's a classic know what you know what you don't know leadership rule that George H.W. Bush aspired to. And again, from my perspective, just, always found himself at the right place at the right time. He was also the right guy for our country at the right time as well.
Yeah, he also knew the world. He had served as ambassador to China, and he had a sense of America's role as global leader. We've sort of backed away from that now, and I'm curious, just from your perspective, is that because that's simply the new reality? There are other countries, we're going to be a multipolar world again, or is that a consequence of presidential leadership?
I think it's a little bit of presidential leadership. And look at what happened this past weekend at the G20. You've got the Russia taking these Ukraine sailors, and the world doesn't do anything about it. George Bush was the type of person that said, this will not stand. That's what he said about the Iraqis taking over Kuwait at the time. There's no outrage with what Russia did inside of Ukraine. No one seems interested in it. Our president is concerned more about, you know, a deal he's going to make with China. So we live in a very different world, and a lot of it has to do with presidential leadership.
Give us the Ukraine update. What is our obligation there if that should go to war?
No, it's not good from a tactical perspective on the ground right now. The Russians still hold 24 Ukraine sailors. Their ships refuses to release them. The Ukraine military is calling up reservists, and they're concerned about the areas along the Crimean border there with Russia. The war drum seems to be beating. This is Vladimir Putin has a very hard line about Ukraine getting close to the West, especially inside of NATO. It would probably spur a conflict if Ukraine decided to do that. We have no other obligation to them at this point, unfortunately.
So if Putin wants to take over Ukraine, we will not challenge him.
As of right now, it doesn't seem like we've got the political will to do anything at this point, except we've sent some anti-tank weapons. We've sent a little bit more than the previous administration did when Trump made some comment about the previous administration sent blankets and Band-Aids. That was true. We've sent a few more defensive weapons, but we would be putting the Ukraine government in a position where the Russian army would likely take over it very quickly.
CBS military analyst, retired Army Major Mike Lyons. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Dave.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Monday morning means it's time to go to Jill Schlesinger, CBS News senior business analyst. And there seems to be a lot of good news. Let's start with the stock market. The official reports indicate that stocks are not overvalued and banks are well capitalized and all seems rosy.
Yes, isn't it better? Everything's done. Fabulous. So last week, there were a couple of things that happened that really powered the stock market ahead, and it had to do with the Federal Reserve. First, we got the Federal Chair Jerome Powell saying that the interest rates that the Fed controls, the Fed funds rate, those rates were just below the rate that is designed to neither speed up nor slow down economic growth. So we call that the neutral rate. And he said last week, we're just below that. Now, 6 weeks ago, he said we're a long way off from neutral. So we've actually seen a big change in the Fed, probably because some of the economic activity has slowed down, specifically in the housing sector, in the agricultural sector. And overall, we're just not growing as fast. That's one thing. And the second part is that the Fed did release its inaugural financial stability report, which you absolutely are correct, says that, you know, look, banks are, they're not perfect, but they're better capitalized, and that's good. There are still risks that exist, and the Fed is keeping an eye on those risks, including the Brexit, Eurozone problem, trade tensions, geopolitical uncertainty. But maybe one of those issues maybe just kind of got a little breathing room, because over the weekend, China and the U.S. are taking a bit of a pause, a little time out, Dave.
That sounds like good news too, that China is going to reduce tariffs on American car imports.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is something important here about this announcement. It is not really a deal yet. And I think that maybe, you know, I'm a little bit nervous because I always sort of feel like I'm Charlie Brown kicking the football, right? One more time, I'm going to tee it up. Lucy's going to snatch that football away at the last second. There are still a number of issues that need to be ironed out between the United States and China. We're talking about the requirement that forces U.S. companies to share their cutting-edge technology with Chinese companies, the theft of intellectual property. We certainly know about the cybercrime issues. But absolutely, if we can get through this and China starts buying more of our agricultural products, lowers some of the tariffs, maybe we get to a deal. But boy, 90 days is not a long time. These are issues that have been on the table for all of 2018. So it'll be interesting to see where we go next.
Well, and that is welcome news considering the General Motors announcement of the layoffs, of course. Are there any other shoes to drop along those lines, Jill?
I don't know. I mean, the General Motors news is one. I think that was not surprising, but there was a bit of an inconsistency. And I think a week later that people are really starting to dig under this announcement and they're saying, wait a minute. So let's see. General Motors said they want to invest in electric, but they're closing down one of the plants that creates one of their electric vehicles. So how does that jibe?
Yeah.
And I think that more and more, many of the critics of GM are starting to say, obviously, this is just what you do to run a business, but you know, then don't start to tell us that it's because you want to do electric vehicles since you're shutting one of the plants down that creates electric vehicles. And maybe part of the problem with them is that the U.S. citizenry doesn't really want electric vehicles right now. Gas back down, you know, from high of 70 recently to about 50, and oil prices rather. And we keep buying big trucks and SUVs. And so it looks like there's like a bifurcated car market. You buy a truck or an SUV from an American car company. You buy a small sedan or a compact car from other producers, whether those are German or from Japan.
The other big story is this data breach at Marriott. And for people who do a lot of business travel, of course, this is of concern. And we're told, and now we're talking this time, is a half a billion names. I mean, how big do these things get, right? You put the various things you can do. Putting a freeze on your credit file was one of the suggestions, but that means you can't use your card either, right?
Isn't that a good thing? Doesn't that, it does like a double
no.
duty. It's a perfect thing. Here's why. All right. I am like the biggest cheerleader for the freeze. And here, this is the reason. You're absolutely right. When you put a credit freeze on your credit file, it will stop almost all access to your credit report, including by you. Okay. But if you already have credit cards, you already have a mortgage, you already have a car loan, you probably aren't accessing your credit file too much. So presuming that you have the credit you need, and by the way, I have to assume after being a financial planner for many years, most people have all the credit they need by a certain point, then you leave it alone. If you need to go buy a new car and you're going to get a car loan, unfreeze it. It takes a few days. Then put the freeze back on. The reason I think this is a very important step is that it finally, once and for all, will lock down your information. As you said, this is a half a billion people. Put this on top of the Equifax breach. Put this on top of the Yahoo data breach.
Yeah.
Let's just presume for the future, your information has already been compromised. And maybe it hasn't been used yet, but once you freeze your file, you'd go a long way into stopping any potential damage.
Okay, so that does not stop you from using your card then?
No, believe me when I say, like, you're going to use, go crazy if you want. No, don't go crazy. But you can use whatever credit you have. This is opening new credit.
I see. So freezing your credit file means that you would not be able to get a mortgage, for example.
Right. You wouldn't be able to actually get new credit in your name.
I see. All right. Well, I guess that makes sense. And the fraud alert, how's that different from the credit freeze?
The fraud alert is kind of like a baby step. It requires financial institutions to take some precautions to verify your identity before opening a new account. So, you know, maybe that's an additional card or increasing the credit limit on your existing account. It may make it a little bit harder for a criminal to do some damage, but it's not as good as a credit freeze. So, sure, put a fraud alert on there. Put a notification on every single one of your credit cards that says, pick some amount of money and just say, hey, let me know if there's an expense of more than this amount. I actually think the credit card companies have become very, very good in their security precautions.
Yeah.
And I'll just give a shout out to, I think that the folks at American Express have spent a ton of money to do this. And they're very good at spotting weird things that happen. And essentially, they'll let you know, hey, we think something weird's happened. We're sending you a new card.
Yeah, very helpful.
Yeah.
CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Jill, thank you.
Thank you.